Tonight, Shapeshifter is somebody who's involved in a multi-generational business, and businesses, family businesses, notoriously more difficult to manage than ordinary businesses, which are difficult enough to manage, frankly. Most struggle in dealing between generations, where parents struggle to hand over children, siblings end up scrapping, and issues about who got the most pocket money when you were seven end up manifesting in the boardroom 40 years later. It can get very messy. Adulting is hard, and some people struggle to adapt more than others. Does it become more complicated over 80 years when you've got a third generation who are trying to figure out how to run a business started by a grandparent? And now cousins and second cousins are getting involved, and they will have kids, and there will be this dilution through the generations. Well, Philip Retief is the chief executive of Van Leeuweren Vineyards. You would know the brand. You'll know the Van Leeuweren brand. They made a lovely columbard when I was at university. Slightly sweet. I've grown the sweetness, though. They've got the Four Cousins range, which is possibly even more famous than the vineyards themselves. But before we talk about today, take me back to Robertson, 1937, a 22-hectare pig citrus ostrich farm. I mean, that's the start of this family multi-generational empire, if you like.
Yes, Bruce, like most businesses, they tend to start small, and that's what happened with Van Leeuweren. It was an ostrich business, some citrus, some cows, some pigs, some real, almost subsistence farming in 1937, and then that was the start of where we are today, and humble beginnings, and very proud of that, but I've gone a long way since then.
Who was your grandfather? I mean, what was his gig? What motivated him to go and find a spot in the Robertson Valley of all places, which was even further away in those days than it is now, off the beaten track?
Yeah, he's actually from Paul, and his father, so my great-grandfather, helped him purchase the farm in 37. They were a large family, and obviously there wasn't enough space in Paul for them, so he ventured out to the outskirts then, and as I said, that's the start of the history.
When did Robertson become more of a wine area? I mean, we know it is a wine area now, and there's some really good quality wines coming out of Robertson, but it wasn't always the case, was it?
Yeah, historically it was. It is a Karoo area. It's very dry. We don't have enough rain for farming in our area, so we're dependent on a water scheme. So yeah, we know all about the Cape drought, and water is a key factor in farming. And our water literally comes from, if I can geographically state that, out of the Litoy Kloof Mountains, and that's where you go through the tunnel as you enter the north from Cape Town, and that's where our water would come from. And in the late 1940s, there was a big holding dam built in Worcester, the Brunfley Dam, and that gave substance to 28,000 hectares that could be developed over the next 50 to 70 years. So the land itself wasn't worth much, but with the water, that made the big difference. And then gradually diversification into wine and grapes. Initially, a lot of bulk grapes. Most of it was sold wholesale to those days, the old distillers and Stellenbosch Farmers and KWV.
Well, they really dominated the market. I mean, they were making price and buying what they wanted when they wanted it, and the farmers really didn't have much power in that relationship.
Yeah, no, it was before demutualization. The export markets were closed, and the local market was basically owned by three or four or five big players. So you were pretty much price takers at farm gate, and that was the reason why many of the farms decided to start small and start a winery, and at a later point, then start their own brands, and that really was a catalyst for us as well.
Did your dad and uncle, because they followed your grandfather into the business, were they the first ones to plant the vines?
No, they were vines, but they did start the expansion in the 60s, and then they decided in the 70s to do cold fermentation. Now that's where you go from fortified wine, red muscadel type of wines, to where you can make good quality white wines. So then we were at the point where we had a lot of bulk wine. We had bulk wine that we sold to, as I said, to the big wholesalers at that stage. And then they were still farmers. I mean, in essence, they were agricultural farmers that made wine, pretty much still price takers. And then they had the vision of starting the Van Leeuweren wine brand in 1980. And that's how our business transformed, as we always say, from a production-driven business to a trademark-driven business.
I mean, did they just see the opportunity in bottled wine? I mean, the wine industry then, I just remember 1980s dinner parties were dominated by Niederberg. You either had the Stein or you had the Cabernet.
Yes, correct. And then all the others, there's Zonnebloem and Vlieder Cup and Grasse and all those. Those are all the Stella brands. I'm a great company. And yeah, we can learn a lot from them. But yes, they were politely or pleasantly jealous about the fact that their wine goes on dinner tables or on the shelves of retailers. And they wanted to do something themselves. And that's how it started, literally with 500 cases of Premier Grand Cru in 1980.
What is Premier Grand Cru?
Well, you don't. It's a blend of any combination of white wines. Yeah, it's not specific that it has to be Sauvignon Blanc or Chenin or Chardonnay. It could be any blend, and it's just a termination for dry white. But it's something that but outdated.
It sounds much posher for 1970s language. Premier Grand Cru. Oof.
Yeah, it comes from France. I mean, it's a French name. So that everything that sounds posh probably is French. Many of those names we're not allowed to use anymore, like Champagne. We're not allowed to use the word champagne. We call it MCC.
Gey Korsted, who was South Africa's answer to Andrea Bocelli in the 1970s, had this most hilarious song about just the superiority of Europe and alles ist besser in Europa. And again, there was that sort of cultural affiliation, I suppose, which did it. Yeah, it formed a lot of how many people think and thought at the time. But that started it. I mean, this idea of producing the Premier Grand Cru, getting into the bottled wines. When did you and your cousins, are you all four cousins or some of you brothers? Because we go under the four cousins label. How did you all get into the business?
Yeah, we all went to university in the late 80s, early 90s, and we are two sets of brothers. Each dad has the two sons that joined the business. We are the four directors, but we affectionately refer to ourselves as the cousins in the business. And yeah, when you spoke about family businesses at the start, it made me smile because it does come with its unique opportunities. And I think we are, I don't want to say challenges, because we really are, I think, a very good example of how to farm in a family business environment. And I think we're doing a lot of things right. Yeah. We joined in the after university, I think from about 93 to 98. Two of us are in production, my brother Neil and my cousin Henny. They're farmers, viticulturists. My cousin Basil is a winemaker, cellar master, and I take care of the rest. Yeah. So, but we form a great team, and we've had very little bust-ups, I must say.
But you've broken up the business into manageable pieces. They're very clear lines of responsibility. I mean, without that, it's just a family free-for-all. It's not a business.
No, that's true. And we always want to keep the family values as core, but you have to move to a slightly more corporate environment, especially looking at the fourth generation, because that will be a bit more challenging but also exciting. And yes, we've got agriculture, primary agriculture. We've got the vertical integration into the winery cellar where we make the wine. And then we do most of our sales and marketing, if not all of it, ourselves. So you can say there are three divisions within the entity, and then the different structural lines and responsibility lines, which does help. Yeah.
When your grandfather started, he bought that small bit of land with the help of his dad, the 22 hectares. How much land are you farming now?
Under irrigation, we've got about 750 hectares. So yes, substantially increased.
Yeah, I mean, and you were talking about just how dry that valley is, but you do have the constant supply of water. So irrigation remains a possibility even through the Western Cape drought. I mean, must have been hectic.
Last year was hectic. It was the driest it has been ever. We only had 50% of our allocation, our normal allocation, which means that you had to be much more clever and intelligent as to how you manage the water. And even the farmers that have been there for many years, all of them have learned something out of this drought. I think we were in a position where we were a bit water wastage orientated, put it that way. And yeah, we definitely are more intelligent and savvy with how we utilize our water at this stage.
Export markets. At one stage, you were going quite big into the export markets. I think that helped shape the business when the cousins took over. But are you more local now? I mean, I've seen your videos on your website, and you've got this magnificent homestead and spread, beautiful flat valley with huge, generous bunches of grapes. I mean, that's all well and good, but is the local market big enough for you?
The local market is big enough. It's actually also small at the same stage. Maybe just back. I mean, in the 90s, when the export markets opened, the sanctions were lifted. South Africa was the new kid on the block, and we affectionately refer to it as the honeymoon period. Everybody wanted our wine in the world. It was fairly easy to gain new market, etc. And then 10 years later, in the 2000s, then we were just one of the players: Australia, Chile, Argentina, and then all the European big boys: Spain, Italy, and France. So we were then competing on a fair foot. And as South Africa positioned itself, unfortunately, slightly low, so we've got a bit of a low price negative connotation in the world markets because we're very fragmented. Industry, Van Loeferen did well in that stage. We exported quite a bit of wine. At one stage it was 60% of our total business, mainly to the UK. And we made a conscious decision in about 2000 that we wanted to focus on the local market. You could be the master of your own destiny to a large extent. It's very difficult to build a brand on the international markets. There is actually not one South African brand that we can say owns the respect of the international market as a whole. So it's difficult. So yes, we focused on South Africa. We've done well here, and now the last 5 years we've started expanding again back into the international markets, but strategically.
We'll hear about that in just a second. There's also a brandy. There's whiskey lines as well. 5, 8, and 12-year-old whiskies. More and more people making the whiskies. The wines, though. It's interesting. I mean, in my student days, Van Leeuwen was very firmly in the value range, but they've also got themselves into the single vineyards, and they've got themselves into more of a premium category too. Talk about that. Okay. The wonderful story of the four cousins who worked together to create the four cousins wine brand, Van Leeuwen and Vineyards. But you've got a bigger range than any other family vineyards in South Africa, surely. I mean, across the price spectrum, you've diversified into whiskies, into beers, into brandy. I mean, is there anything you don't do?
Maybe in liquor, not at the moment. We don't do a rum, but let's leave that for later. Yeah, we want to diversify into other categories of liquor. We've had some success in some categories, the cream category.
You've got a Marula cream, which looks right, like you're having a go at those other guys.
It might be, yes, that's right. It might be, and the craft gin market is very exciting at the moment. But we've also learned that you do think you know wine and you understand wine, you know how to do it, but the categories definitely are significantly different. And the main reason for that is that you have big power brands. If you take whiskey, for example, or brandy, or gin or beer, you've got maybe 15 brands. But go to a wine shelf, and you get cluttered by stickers on a bottle, which some people say. So yeah, it's a different game, different sales technique, different people that you need. So yes, we have diversified, but we are cutting off a bit and focusing back on the wine. And then typically you've got the pyramid where you've got your top end small volume but high value brands, good margins. And then you've got in between your mid-range lifestyle premium brands, and then you've got popular premium where four cousins would fit in. And then below that you might have the real entry level high volume, very low margin brands, which we try not to play in. And the South African market is sizable but small. Quantum, it's 400 million liters, which means on average we consume 7 liters per annum, which is half a bottle per month, which is a glass every second week.
I do my best to up the averages.
I think many of us do. But yeah, so there's great opportunity for growth, and the growth is outside. Is in the other categories of liquor, not necessarily within wine. Yeah.
Explain to me how you got the King involved, because you've got the Bayerde brand as well. This is the brand of King Goodwill's Relatini.
Yes, Bayerde means Hail the King. It's a joint venture where we are the producer under license for the King. Obviously, it fits into the empowerment bracket and et cetera on that. It's not necessarily easy. The fact that you have a brand which is associated with a King doesn't mean that product will sell on shelf. I think with new brands, and especially empowerment brands, it's important to have a brand that first and foremost speaks to the consumer, and then you can sell the empowerment angle to it, because consumers don't necessarily, or very few of them, basically purchase decision on the fact that a brand might be empowered and or not.
Yeah. When does the next generation come in?
They differ in age between 11 and 23, 24. So soon and shortly, we've got some guidelines in place. Not all of them will necessarily join. Some might join and think there's entitlement, and they might leave again. Others might come in with a bang. So we'll see. They're more than welcome, and we embrace that, and it will be obviously great for the future of the family legacy if they do get involved in different spheres of the business.
Is Van Leeuwen a tough family school?
No, not at all. I think we had it fairly easy, if I can call it the cousins now. We worked hard, I'm going to make no mistake, but there weren't many structures in place. We were really operational for many years, and now with a bigger team and senior management in place and a bigger staff complement, we've become obviously more managers, more strategically, more guidance in that process. So when the next generation comes in, it will be different from how we joined the business. It's not a question of just saying one day, "Hi, Dad, I'm here." Now it's you have to go and we try to encourage them to get a university degree or some form of a diploma. They need to travel the world and also work elsewhere. I think that's quite important to understand the culture of another business, and then they can slot in. There's quite a wide variety as you in any business.
Sure.
Production, sales, Philip, marketing.
We must leave it there. But Philip Retief, thank you for sharing the story of Van Leeuwen Vineyards, the four cousins. I now understand it better. And have a look at the website. It really does give you a sense of the vast spread that these guys are tackling and taking, going from international back to local and now looking back once again outside the country to take advantage, of course, of the huge spread that they produce at Van Leeuwen.